The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Preparing the Ruins, the 2015 Annual Conference Recordings, copyright 2015. If you have purchased this recording, you may make additional copies for use by your school. You may not sell copies of the recording, nor post it on the Internet. Learn more about classical Christian education and ACCS at www.accsedu.org.
Why would a philosopher come and talk to heads of schools? Some of you will be wondering that by the time I'm done. I think it's because I believe, and I mean this with all my heart, that with homeschool moms, you are the hope of the West. Which, if I were you, would make me wonder if the West is doomed. Because I'm a bit of a depressive. I used to work as a head of school, and whenever I would come to a conference like this, I would go to two sorts of meetings. There were the practical meetings that made me feel inadequate and guilty. This is not that thought. Then there were what I thought of as, and wrote in my notebook, the blah, blah, blah talks. I would actually write, blah, blah, blah. You may do that if you please. That attempted to inspire me. And I'm very difficult as a depressive to inspire. Every time I start to get inspired, I look within myself and realize, once again, that total depravity is the one Christian doctrine no one ever argues with. But I want to give you the temperature today. If you are indeed the hope of the West, then the West is indeed in perilous shape. Because if we all look at the educations we likely received, it's a sign of the decline of the West that most of us can teach high school and that I can teach in a university. Most of us receive in college the equivalent of a Victorian women's seminary education. Women aspired for centuries to get into Oxford. They were finally let in, and then Oxford destroyed itself, becoming more like what was offered to closeted and cosseted Victorian women than the robust and rigorous challenge that many of your schools still present to students today. I'd like to start by thanking my high school teachers who worked in an unaccredited, unimportant Christian school that my dad founded when the local public school told him not to drop by because they were the professionals and they knew what they were doing. The Reynoldses came to the United States about 1622 around Jamestown. And for 300 odd years, none of us went to high school, let alone college. And then following the Second World War, everyone decided that we needed to be credentialed. And so my poor father was sent to high school, college, and seminary, leaving nothing for the rest of us to do. Also, that generation of Reynoldses could do precisely the same jobs they had done before they spent tons of money and time getting credentialed. I'm the first Reynolds to live in the United States in 400 years that actually needs all the credentialing they acquired to do their day job. And from this little Christian school, I learned two things. First of all, when my mom, who was a high school graduate, was teaching the learning disabled students to read that the rest of the government schools had given up on, we were quite the place. And then the day came when they hired a graduate to be principal, and he cleaned up the school, straightened it up, made it official and shiny and good, and we declined in importance and effectiveness. Sadly, I was that principal. If we are not careful, we will internally have what every homeschool student that I meet in places like the Torrey Honors Institute or Houston Baptist University thinks. We know we got a good education. We believe we got a good education. But somehow we have to go to Harvard. We have to go someplace and prove that what we did was really equivalent to what secular society said it was. And so in the world that we live, classical Christian schools, if they are not careful, will sell their souls for a bowl of secularist pottage, and I promise you this, they won't even give you the soup. And that's a problem. I mean, if you're going to sell out, at least be like Judas and spend the money instead of throwing it back. If you're going to damn your soul, go out with style. Don't go out cringing and crawling, asking to sit in the back of secularism's bus. I got some good news and some bad news. I'll start, because I enjoy it, with the bad news. I told you I was a depressive, so this is the part I really like. We are doomed. It used to be when I would say that to people a decade ago, I would get accused of by my bosses of apocalyptic thinking. Come on, it can't be that bad. I finally got to the point where I had to cheer up people. Because most of you accept the fact that we are within a decade of facing serious problems as institutions from the government. My godfather is Philip E. Johnson, who clerked for Earl Warren on the Supreme Court, graduated first in his class from the University of Chicago. Probably most famous in this group for writing Darwin on Trial. I speak with him every Tuesday. He tries to straighten me out. He's not responsible for the stupid things I say today, but for much of the good. And if Phil were here, he would tell you the legal environment is such that do not rely on the law. You have no hope. Even if for a little while religious freedom appears to protect you, you will not long remain acceptable to the broader society. You are, and this is so offensive to me, as I'm sure it is to you, morally wicked by the standards of the elites of our culture. And it's easy enough to dismiss this, because most of you wouldn't have the jobs you have if you cared about elite opinion, at least a lot. But I'm from a church where today two of our leaders are kidnapped in Syria and no one knows if they are alive. Where today ISIS will behead members of my church. Ultimately, it matters what the elites think, because it's easy to say that the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church, but on the whole, I would prefer not to see my children die. There is the abstraction of persecution. And then there is 600 years of living under pain and rule as second-class citizens, paying a special tax, unallowed into higher leadership, serving as the cleanup crew for the elite's mistakes. 600 years of bondage. I do not wish that on my children or on my grandchildren, but if we do not act prudently in the situation that we are in within our schools, if we do not get a vision for a strategic position that can change what is happening, we face this not from Islam, that great antichrist spirit that boiled out of Arabia, but from the libertine secularists who are our own children and grandchildren, who with a soft tyranny will seduce us into hell. Not by chopping off our heads, but by castrating our intellectual capacity to boldly proclaim that Jesus Christ is Lord to the glory of God the Father. To say what must be said kindly, winsomely, but to say it nonetheless. When I am afraid to blog on certain topics on Patheos, where I blog daily, because of the emails I receive from cultural leaders who say that people with your opinions should not be allowed any public forum in the United States because you are so hateful, I am tempted to withdraw, to take the option of retreat, to think with Louis XV that this time will last my time. I'm 52 at the end of this month. Surely I can stumble along as an administrator in some institution of Christian higher education until it's time to retire, draw my pension, and hide. What I like about the people here from Idaho is they did not move to Idaho to retreat into their own very private Idaho, but they moved to Idaho to change the world for the gospel of Jesus Christ. There is no Benedict option, because against the shadow of that hideous strength of our time, we will not be allowed to retreat. There will be no place to hide. If for centuries people could hope to come to America, as the Church of Lebanon and Syria often did, the warning is this: there is no America for Americans to retreat to. We are the last best hope of humankind on earth, which means we are in trouble. Will we retreat to Uganda? Or to South Korea, whose existence depends on America's will and force of arms? Will we retreat to Taiwan or Singapore, who stand on the edge of a massive globally arming power in China that is still officially atheistic and who today has inside of work camps all over China Christians standing up to their waist in dung, shoveling it for naming the name of Christ? If the Blue Water American Navy disappears from the Pacific, does anyone believe that the Tiger Nations on the rim will long be free? Sub-Saharan Africa, partly through the mess of colonialism, is no retreat or haven. South America is equally corrupted with us by the poisonous spew that came forth from Hollywood, that after World War II decided that personal peace and affluence was sufficient for human life, that a well-fed, well-trained, happy human was not the human of the Declaration, but the human of a Skinner box. Well-fed, well-comforted, a pet for the omnipotent state. There is no retreat to Central or South America, where the elites are just like the elites here. And I have stood at the University of Mongolia in Ulaanbaatar giving a talk, and if I looked at what then was a bulletin board, or looked at the students as they passed me in the hall, I might as well have been in Southern California. The university class of this world, whether it's in France or Britain or Austin or Berkeley or Idaho, has more in common with each other than they do with the farmer two blocks away. If you look at any state, I can identify the University of Rochester and Cornell, the two major universities of upstate New York, simply by looking at the voting patterns of upstate New York. Upstate New York will be deeply red across the board, carried by Mitt Romney in every case, except those counties in which the university class is located. And I'll tell you this, I'm from rural West Virginia, which some people have said is kind of redundant. There isn't an urban West Virginia. Sugar Land, where I'm from, is 100,000 people. It's nearly the whole state of West Virginia. But in West Virginia, we can vote for family, we can vote for life, we can do whatever must be done, but no one at the University of West Virginia or Marshall University cares at all what West Virginians say. It is the educational class, our profession, that has committed treason against the gospel of Jesus Christ and against the founding principles of our nation. We work in the most corrupt industry on the face of the planet. And to believe that as Christians we are immune from the seduction of that industry is arrogance. We are all of us tempted to trim, to hedge, to qualify. I'm an analytically trained philosopher. I can barely make a statement without saying perhaps. Perhaps I'm here. Possible that I'm an illusion created by you. If so, you've done a really bad job. I wish I looked more like Mel Gibson and sounded more like Charlton Heston. One of those voices often confused with a woman on the phone, but I'm not confused, by the way. I am, in fact, a man. Which itself means I am privileged and cisgendered, mansplaining to you what's going wrong in the culture. I no longer have to be listened to because I bear the burden of my affluent West Virginia upbringing. We didn't even have a library, which meant that we still prayed in schools when it was unconstitutional to do so. And I admire those women who led those schools, who told the Supreme Court, "We do not submit to you. And if we want to pray, we will. Are you going to send the entire state of West Virginia to jail?" They tried that when my grandfather was running moonshine, and it didn't work. And it's no more likely to work when we pray. Are we listening to the prophets? And if so, where will we find the prophets? I'd like to suggest to you that many people struggle with the problem of evil. Where is God? Why doesn't God warn us about what's going on in the world? How do you know He doesn't? I'll tell you a story I know to be true. I can't prove it if you're an atheist, but I heard my grandfather say it, and my grandfather never told me a lie. During the 1920s, my grandfather was out farming as a young teenage boy who had just come to faith in Jesus Christ. And he had a vision of a clownish-looking man dressed in military garb, riding a horse. And as the man went by, sort of amusing-looking, buffoonish, with all his medals and ribbons, the backside of the horse was missing and trailing blood. And God said to my grandfather, "Do not trust this man." Later, my grandfather picked up a newspaper and for the first time in his life saw a rising German politician named Adolf Hitler. And this man with his sixth grade education, who could quote Chaucer to the day he died, knew not to trust that man. But Charles Lindbergh wasn't listening. The hero of the age was hanging out with Goebbels and Goering. And the intellectual elites on the right, including, sadly, people like G.K. Chesterton, were a bit taken in because, after all, nothing could be worse than Stalin. Meanwhile, on the left, the intellectual elites were going to Stalin's Russia and looking at Moscow and saying, proclaiming in the papers, we've seen the future and it works. Well, I'll confess to you something that my grandfather was wrong about. He believed that Adolf Hitler was the Antichrist. And he was wrong. Hitler was merely an Antichrist, part of the general Antichrist spirit that is always abroad in the earth. But let me ask you a very simple question. Would you rather have been wrong like my grandfather and believe that Hitler was the Antichrist, or believe like the elite of the intellectual circles of Britain on the right that Hitler was the salvation from Bolshevik tyranny? Would you rather have believed like my sixth grade graduate grandfather that Stalin might be the Antichrist? Or believe, like the press of the time, that the future, the bend of history, was with the Soviet Union? If your school has to be wrong about something, rightly identify the Antichrist spirit of our age and stand against it with all your force. Because the bend of history is uncertain except for this fact. Jesus Christ is Lord to the glory of God the Father. And the Church of Jesus Christ is always losing to someone, just to someone new. Hitler and Stalin are gone. You remain. You are always weaker than the shadow that is coming. But now I feel like preaching. And so let me turn to what happens to a culture in decline. There are two things that can happen to a culture in decline. One very likely and one highly unlikely, but petrifyingly possible and so frightening. And so let me lay out for you, using the example of 1917 Russia, what can happen in the worst case scenario. Here's the good news. Generally speaking, cultures muddle through. The nice thing about being a conservative is that I generally don't think that the next presidential election is going to bring on a new golden age. Nor is it going, look at the presidential candidates. King Arthur is not to be found amongst them unless you think Donald Trump and his comb over are the second coming of Camelot. Nor are we likely to see the fall of the West occur in some dramatic sense that occurred with the sack of Constantinople in 1453. We're infinitely more likely to muddle through on some general trajectory of decline or some general trajectory of moral improvement. And sadly, this is in some ways for us as Christian school leaders harder to deal with. Because if you warn against the problems of our time, you get what I call the Elvis response. And maybe I'm the only one that's ever heard this. If you say, wow, Miley Cyrus, yick. Someone will say this. Your parents' generation, in the case of some of you, your grandparents' generation, worried about Elvis appearing on the Ed Sullivan Show. And then the next generation, there's an entire Andy Griffith episode where Helen Crump preaches this sermon. The kids are okay. The grown-ups are always worried about the kids. And the kids, your parents worried about you. Here's the news. Elvis was more decadent than Bing Crosby, who was more decadent than Tin Pan Alley, because we have been in a general sexual moral decline since about the 1920s. It's just slow. As human beings count slowness. But after all, there are still people alive today who were alive in the 1920s. Elvis was more decadent. And the fact that Elvis can now be listened to as a pathway back to better music shouldn't cheer us up. It should make us sad. The degenerate music of my grandparents' generation is now more rhythmically and musically complex than what my children listen to. The kids are not okay. They generally stink worse than you did. This is so cheerful. Go to your school. Hi, everyone. You stink worse than I did. You're even dumber than I was. This goes over very well. I would try it. Now, as my daddy would say, who pastored for 50 years, if you love the sheep, they'll take a lot if you're one of them. But if they sense that you're using them or selling them something, they won't even take good news from you. Go love the sheep and tell them the truth. Here's some bad news, however. Never bet that the West will rapidly collapse and will move into a horrible time. You're almost always wrong. But it does sometimes happen. Cultures do sometimes get to tipping points where they simply cannot overcome the external and internal threats to their situation. And so instead of declining slowly or declining quickly, they collapse almost immediately. And I'm going to use Russia as an example, but I could use several tipping point places. Before we say anything else about Russia, I have to disabuse you of communist propaganda that most of us still believe. If you went to any education in the 70s or 80s, or even the early 90s, remind yourself that almost everything we knew about Russia was filtered through Soviet historians or what the Soviets would allow us to know. Remind yourself that in 1913, the average Russian peasant was better fed than the average German peasant. That Russian economic growth around 1913 outstripped almost any nation in Europe. Russia has never achieved such economic growth again. That Russia was in a cultural silver age. If your school reads any Russians, who are the authors they read? Who are they? Who do you read? If you read anybody in English translation, who do you read? And Chekhov. And if you listen to music, who do you probably listen to in your school? Tchaikovsky, Rachmaninoff. You'll notice that they're all clustered around the end of the 19th and early 20th century during the reign of the incompetent, quote-unquote, last Russian czar. Russia was going through its own Dickensian period of industrial growth with all the problems that occurred. But in 1913, the tricentenary of Romanov rule in Russia, as the Tsar walked through crowds, hundreds of thousands of people would spontaneously fall to their knees and sing the Russian national anthem, God Save the Tsar. Russian bonds were not plummeting on the global bond market. I have some of them hanging on my wall. If the czars are ever restored, I will be rich. It's like my I have stock in the Titanic as well. If it just makes it to New York City, all is well. I wondered how much of it has to make it to New York City for me to cash in, but here's my point. After a culture utterly collapses and is replaced by something worse, anybody can tell you what the seeds of that collapse were. We all knew it. Because there's always somebody like John Mark Reynolds telling you we're doomed. And if they happen to get it right, they look like a prophet. But I will tell you this, there are five characteristics that every culture has if it gets to a tipping point and cannot survive. And still, those cultures generally muddle through. Let me tell you what they are. First, there is a certain class of people that have a kind of traditional conservative cultural power that still believe in the old system that no one else believes in. In fact, this exactly describes the last Russian czar and a kind of reactionary Russian intellectual class that saw in Pan-Serbianism or in a restoration of some kind of pure 14th century czarist rule the best hope to defeat what they viewed as the Western plague of nihilism, Marxism, and sexual degeneracy. Sound familiar? This is Vlad Putin's plan. Nothing new about this. A revival of the autocracy would produce a new Russia, which is why during the tricentenary, the Tsar and his wife were pictured in the garb of 1613, not the garb of 1913. There is a class of traditionalists who become reactionaries, not with a progressive vision of what the world can become. This problem exists when the Church of Jesus Christ writes books about the future and they're all dystopian or left behind. We have no vision of what the church would look like if we colonized Mars. We instead look to a golden age that never existed, and we double down on a system that many people no longer believe in. The second sign of a culture that's going to collapse is the failure of the intellectuals to, by and large, outside of this reactionary group that huddles around what's left of the right, the failure of the intellectuals to support the state. Tolstoy, himself morally reprehensible, was as responsible for anyone for bringing on the Russian Revolution through his foolish goo-gooism and belief that somehow if you just hung out with the peasants long enough, good would come of it. The help is in the proles, to paraphrase 1984. Now, I'm from West Virginia. Poor people are just as rotten as rich people. We just don't have the money to be as rotten. We are protected in West Virginia from the vices of the wealthy by our poverty. If you don't believe this, look at what happens to a West Virginian who wins the lottery. We don't have the money for very long. And we're worse off than when we had won. But when our intellectual class becomes entirely disassociated with the constitutional order that created them, this is the second sign of a culture that may not muddle through. Third is widespread but nominal religion. The very people who in 1913 would bow in the little churches in the villages of Russia were often the same people who were crucifying the same priest to the church door of that very church. Because too often in Russia, religion meant being Russian. It didn't mean being Christian. And there was no real saving faith inside the heart. There was merely the nominal acceptance of a cultural or state Christianity as opposed to the acceptance of the Lordship of Jesus Christ in every facet of life. It's no wonder that the young intellectuals like Lenin or Stalin rejected Christianity once they went to school. I want to remind you of something. When you read from atheists that Stalin went to seminary, they're telling you a falsehood. Strictly speaking, of course, Stalin did go to a seminary because most Russian higher education and high school education was run by the Orthodox Church. But he received a fine secular classical education. Most of the great Nobel Prize-winning scientists and leaders in the Russian state came through this similar kind of church-related upper education. And the fact that education was spreading so rapidly through church and czarist policies meant that if the First World War had not occurred, Russian literacy would have achieved 100% by the 1920s. Russia was educating itself, and the church, so-called, was deeply involved in that process. But time and time again, what you see is that the classical Christian education given to the people of Russia, far from creating a class that could save the state, or save Russia from imminent peril produced the very leaders of the revolution that would destroy her. Why? Because the best look to the past and the worst look to the future. And the artists were dominated by foolish libertine notions of freedom, and young adults find that toxic mix almost irresistible. And so the Church of Russia educated its own executioners. If classical Christian schools are not careful, we will do what the Jewish community, the traditionally Jewish community, did in the United States, which is turn out many doctors and lawyers and Ivy League graduates and Woody Allen. We will produce students grateful for their good educations because we have empowered them to destroy us. What comes next? In a culture in decline, generally the rise of occult and irrational religions of power. As religious people begin to see the culture slipping away from them, they are sorely tempted to look for their local Rasputin, someone who can do tricks to show them that God is there. That this is the kind of foolish person that almost roots for apocalypse. If only something horrible would happen so we could reboot the culture. Who's that foolish? I'll tell you this, given my vision, I'm not going to survive a new dark age. I don't want to sit in a cave with my stored food, chomping away until the Antichrist comes and drags me away. If the West falls, I'm going to Disneyland one last time with a copy of The Republic, a group of students, discuss the book, sing a hymn, go down Splash Mountain and die. Because I might as well. Rooting for apocalypse or poking around in occultic versions of an irrational religion of power is so foolish that, again, the future cannot be sustained. And finally, we can see the death of a progressive conservative vision. The murder of Pyotr Stolypin and other conservatives who had a vision of what could be done. They soon found themselves marginalized. Why? The temptation. What's the temptation? Anybody think American dating practices are a good idea? If you think that, I have real estate in Southern California I really would love to sell you. It's unsellable. Are you revolutionaries? If so, you are not Christian. Too many Christians look at what's wrong with society and develop revolutionary alternatives that are worse than the secular alternative because it has not been tested and tried over the course of time. We will withdraw ourselves from mainstream society and develop alternative structures, and those alternative structures are the easiest structures for the tyrant, for the perverse, for the bad person to seize control of, manipulate, and abuse. Remember, the Apostle Paul faced the Roman Empire and slavery, and the Apostle Paul did not abolish slavery. He set in motion the inevitable end of slavery while mitigating the abuse of slaves inside the Christian church. He undercut the economic viability of slavery, but he did not attempt to replace a working social system with something he invented out of his own head. But here's the problem. The minute I talk like that, a certain kind of reactionary will claim I'm not pure enough. And have you in your school ever gotten into a holiness contest? My great-granddaddy was a circuit riding preacher in West Virginia. He can only get to certain churches on Thursday. There are still churches in West Virginia that meet on Thursday night. Only they've developed deep biblical reasons for it. Jesus instituted the Lord's Supper on Thursday. Brothers and sisters, you're meeting on Thursday night because Papa was too slow to get to you sooner and too fast to get to you later. They have institutionalized the speed of my great-grandfather's horse. You see, if you get into a holiness contest, you become what my great-grandfather called being so straight, you lean a little. My great-grandfather was once talking to someone and he said, Brother Smith, not his real name, great-grandchildren are still alive, don't want to shame them. Brother Smith, we just don't have many people like the Apostle Paul around anymore. Seemed like a safe thing to say, kind of thing you say after church, like sin, I'm against it. The man looked at him and said, Brother Reynolds, you're looking at one. Now, here's a thought. If the leader of your church has decided that he's the modern equivalent of the Apostle Paul, you are in big trouble. He's almost surely the contemporary equivalent of Demas, who for the love of this present world will sell you out for sex, money, or power. And sure enough, that turned out to be true. You see, if you get in a holiness contest with the local Apostle Paul, you sound like you're a wimp. You're running a classical Christian school. You're making half of what you could at the local public school. You're fighting the good fight. All of your secular neighbors think you are an insane reactionary. But when you tell them that they shouldn't move to a compound with stored weapons, here's a West Virginia rule of thumb. If your leader owns something he calls a compound, you are in trouble. This is inevitable in West Virginia. Look, I got me a compound. No, you're all going to die. But you see, these people who are so straight, they lean a little, are equally revolutionaries. They have equally imbibed the spirit of the age. They are reactionary revolutionaries who believe out of their own heads they can recreate an alternative American culture or pretend that there was a golden age to which they can return. Don't like the sexual problems of our age? I don't either. And I have a picture of my mother at 16, sitting at a church picnic, and it's so beautiful. She has a look in her eyes that no 16-year-old, not even someone homeschooled in a healthy environment, could possibly have. But certain things have never occurred to her. And she's been protected. And I looked at that picture and I thought, why did I have to be born now? And then I looked up in the picture, black and white, and in the picnic pavilion was a sign that said, whites only. Are things better? Or are they worse? Better in some ways, worse in others. Will we stumble through? If you do your jobs, we will. Will the culture collapse? Only if you cease to be progressive conservatives. Those with a vision of what the Church of Jesus Christ could be. Only if you retreat and hide and attempt to recreate the world in one generation. Yes, we're doomed. But isn't it fun? We're likely to muddle through. But what if we don't? Look at the five signs of a culture that won't muddle through. And it used to be that I had to prove this, but I'm going to skip the proof. If we have time for questions, I'll take them. Because I think you probably believe that all five signs exist today. And they have periodically. They existed in 1861 in the United States. I could go back and show you all five signs existed right before the American Civil War, an experience we almost didn't survive. But we muddled through. Did we end up in utopia in 1876 with Rutherford B. Hayes as president, Lemonade Lucy as first lady? No, we did not end up in utopia. We ended up with beards. Ladies, you did not end up with beards, but you had corsets. Which is worse? Well, my wife won't kiss me with a beard, and she's never worn a corset, so I'm voting for beards being worse. But I'm sorry, yes, the bearded people in the room are just thinking I'm not manly enough to grow one. This is true, I'm not. Anglo-Saxon blood runs pure in me. Now, why do we care about this as leaders of Christian schools? You might say to yourself, I can't save the West. What I'm doing is small. I can barely raise enough money to keep the 8th grade going. We aspire someday to have a 9th grade. We have a 9th grade and we can't afford it. Parents keep complaining about lab space. What about insurance? There's so many problems, we don't have time to think about saving the West. And here's my point. If you do what you're doing faithfully, you are saving the West. If you start thinking about saving the West, you'll probably go mad. I want to encourage you to press on. To the best of your ability to be deeply Christian, never compromise with ideas that are contrary to the cause of Christ. Always remember that our students need a living and vibrant encounter with the Lord Jesus Christ, not merely the ability to have been deeply enculturated inside of our classical Christian school culture, lest we produce Stalin. We need a vibrant, winsome faith. But it will be a vibrant, winsome faith that takes what it can from Hollywood, that takes what it can from mainstream television, that takes what it can from mainstream music and redeems it like the spoils of Egypt. If your school can read Homer, the most deeply wicked author I have ever read, it can surely learn to straighten the crooked things of our time. Instead of retreat, a Benedict option, let me instead, in perilous times, call you to a Constantine strategy. The Roman Empire was collapsing. You could double down on old Rome, and it was a giant swamp into which nothing could be put and fix it. And instead of doubling down on a failed strategy, a young emperor decided to do something new. He changed the rules, but he didn't change the rules in a revolutionary way. He built a new Rome in a very defensible place. And because he was egocentric, he named it after himself. I mean, imagine if New St. Andrews had been named New St. Wilson. This is roughly what happened with Constantinople. I am not saying to you that Constantine, who was often a heretic, and only infrequently a Christian, is what we should look for today. Hundreds of years and moral lessons and the truth of the gospel have deeply penetrated us since that time. We do not look for Constantine himself. But we do look for the Constantine strategy, because just like Winston Churchill, that old imperialist and racist, got the biggest moral question of England's time right, that Nazi Germany must be stopped. And so he's honored even by most secularists as a hero. So Constantine got the one thing right in his age, which is that Greco-Roman culture was worth saving, and that only the truth of Christianity could save it. He fused in his own person and in his new city, where pagans never worship, the best of secular education. There was not until 1453 a day when Plato and Aristotle were not studied in Byzantium, the new Rome. Was there a dark age? Not in the East, which preserved for the West the heritage and learning that you use every week in your school. Because Constantine did not retreat. He did not say defeat, nor did he withdraw and attempt to build his own empire on new foundations. Instead, he said, we will be Roman, but we will be Christian. What does that mean? I never meet anybody who doesn't hate Constantine. Left-wingers hate him, right-wingers hate him. Everybody hates Constantine. And I'm often advised not to use him. It's like a double word. But since I got a PhD in Plato, another figure everyone loves to hate and blame for every conceivable problem that exists today, at least read Plato if you're going to blame him for problems. I had to write a book on this topic because I discovered that most evangelicals, left or right, who blame Plato for problems had not actually read Plato. Once went to a conference where somebody quoted a bad thing Plato believed, and it was a quote from Alcibiades, a character in one of the Platonic dialogues that Plato was condemning. It's always a good idea to know what you're talking about before you talk. So let me say this about Constantine. He was not a good man. But he got the big issue right. And if Constantine hadn't lived in God's providence and done what Constantine did in God's good time, if Constantine hadn't ceased the off and on persecution of the church, and he did not, contrary to most Christian textbooks, make Christianity the official religion of the Roman Empire that was left for Theodosius, who went too far. If he had not preserved the learning of ancient Greece and Rome for better times, if the Byzantine or Eastern Roman, they still call themselves Romans, by the way, if you go to Constantinople, the Phanar, where the ecumenical patriarch lives, the Greeks there are called Roman. If they had not gone to cities like Venice and Florence before 1453 and educated those groups of people in the wisdom of the East, there would have been no Renaissance and no Reformation, no Erasmus and no Luther. Were they perfect? No. Should we emulate them directly? Absolutely not. We live in different times. But the Constantine strategy is this. Do not play by the rules of a game you will surely lose. Do not be revolutionary and attempt to start something wholly new on a brand new foundation. And bet on Christianity. The West did not, and it fell into hundreds of years of chaos. The East did, and the long walls that Constantine and his heirs built served as the Minas Tirith of the ancient world, and the fact that most of us are not Muslim is because Constantinople, year after year after year after year, endured so that the West could get back on its feet and create science and culture and the glories of the Reformation. They endured. And they won. It is the atheist given that makes a Byzantine history a long decline. It is the atheist given that claims there was no great secular art. We have very little of the secular art from Constantinople because the Muslims destroyed most of the art when they took it, and when Constantinople was looted by the Venetians, only the religious art survived. We blame Constantinople for her virtues as if they were vices. What does that have to do with you? Imagine instead of a retreat, a Rivendell, that the school you're building is Minas Tirith, the shield of the West. That you are taking the best of traditional American Christian culture. What's good about John Locke? What's good about Hollywood? You're taking Andrei Tarkovsky. And yes, even George Lucas. And you're making the crooked straight, the rough places smooth. You are building a new city. instead of retiring or finding a safe haven, my wife and I have decided to join you. We're doubling down for the next decade by starting a new college and a new K-12 school associated with it. We will not seek Caesar's authority, but we will take what's good about Caesar and appropriate it. Because what's good and true and beautiful belongs to my Lord Jesus. And what is crooked and bent and broken belongs to my Lord Jesus. And it is the job of a Christian higher education institution. It is the job of a Christian K-12 to become ambassadors, reconcilers, a wall, not just to stand against the infidel or the libertine influences of our age. A new Constantinople in every state in the United States, but to create culture. Imagine hundreds of us producing film and novels, most of them bad. Have you been to the multiplex lately? 99% of everything we do will be forgettable. But out of this will come, if we plunge into a new dark age, the next great culture. If we were to plunge into a dark time, I truly believe that there is some school here that would save what can be saved and produce something new. Not repeating what Plato said, or what Aquinas said about Plato, or what Calvin said about Plato, but laboring by grace through faith to say something old and new simultaneously. A conservative progressivism, a progressive conservatism that refuses to let go of the past and also refuses to try to live there. This is the Constantine strategy. Don't emulate his Arianism, but do emulate this. Legend says that in the dying days of the Roman Empire, when the divisions were obvious, he looked up to heaven and saw a cross and heard a voice that said, "In this sign, conquer." Not in this sign, compromise. In this sign, conquer. Ah, somebody back there is saying that word that the Christian left hates and tags me with all the time. You Reynolds are a triumphalist. Yes. The triumph of Jesus Christ is certain and sure. My triumph, not so much. Because you see, in this sign, conquer is itself the dialectic tension of our age. This is the symbol of torture and death, of pain. Jesus tells us, take up your daily and follow me. It is, in one sense, not a sign of victory. You are in an industry where everything is stacked against you, where you cannot possibly prevail, where you'll always be in the back of the bus. But instead of looking for an aspirin, take up the cross like the emperor and say this, in this sign, conquer. Go forth to die. Because you will anyway. But I started with my grandfather. And when Union Carbide killed him, because they couldn't afford the pennies in the 30s to buy him masks, to keep the asbestos from filling his lungs. When he would come home, my grandmother said, with his clothes shot through like snow with asbestos. And as he died, nothing dramatic or awesome about this, drowning to death, his lungs full of fiber. I'll tell you how my grandfather died. The week before he went into the hospital, a man was assaulted outside his house in the city. And my grandfather ran out, cared for the man who had been assaulted, and chased his assailant down the street in his 70s. He came back gasping for air. And my grandmother, Nano, said, "What in the world are you doing?" He said, "What was the guy going to do? Kill me? In this sign, conquer. If you're crucified today, what is Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton or ISIS going to do? Kill you? We've already taken up our cross voluntarily. And we suffer and die with Christ because we surely will be raised with Him." And a week later, as he died, my mother stood by his bedside. And my grandfather, who had seen Hitler and no one had listened to, who didn't have a classical education but knew more classics than I did until well through graduate school. My mother leaned forward because he was talking. He said, "Do you hear it?" "No, Daddy." "Do you hear them?" "No, Daddy. What do you hear?" "The bells, the bells, the bells." You see, my grandfather, who's been forgotten by everyone, not in our family, who was murdered by the company who paid him, built a church with his own hands, and pushed back the darkness of his time. He built a shining city on a West Virginia hill, and it's all gone now, just as the walls of Constantinople have fallen and the Hagia Sophia is a museum. But as he died, he was greeted by the bells of heaven and the King of Kings, the Emperor of all kings, came and greeted him and celebrated him. And if that is not enough for you, if your school needs something more, if it needs to win in this age or get the approval of the spirit of our age, don't be a Christian. Because it's in that sign, the sign of the cross, that we conquer. Go build a city, because someday all the graduates of your school that God has called in His good providence, and you will stand in the new city that's to come, the new Jerusalem, hearing the bells of heaven. Thank you for your time.